I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to the next episode of Two Men in a Bible Fighting the Cosmic Battle. My name's Jamie Sanchez, and I'm joined again by Pastor Bob Brandon. How are you, Bob?
Good. Jamie, how's your battle going?
Hey, it's raging. It is raging. And, I know, the best way for me to describe it, Bob, is I'm on the front lines. I see the rocket's red glare on a daily, if not hourly, basis. But the battle is definitely moving forward, progressing.
So there's no better time to do a podcast than when you're on the front line.
Well, and I think, Bob, as you and I have been talking, I think all of us are on the front line. You know, it's really that recognition, I think, is you know, a big portion of why we wanted to do this podcast, to really help people understand that cosmic battle, and it's not Star Trek, but that cosmic battle doesn't stop, doesn't take a break, it doesn't take a weekend, it doesn't take a timeout. It's constant. And if we go back to Genesis 3, we know why.
That's right. And if you grow lax in your prayers, or lax in your time in the Word, lax in your fellowship, you'll suffer for it.
Right.
Because the battle is constant.
It's almost like chutes and ladders. You get a couple of steps backwards at that point. You go the opposite direction of where you want to go. And so we're almost at the end of Genesis, Bob.
We're close, and this is a big chapter, chapter 49, and we're going to not do our usual. We're not going to dive in and read the words right away. What I'd like to do to set us up for this is read from an author named Alan Ross. He's a great Old Testament scholar, and he's got a book on Genesis, which I use quite a bit. We use maybe five or six books, you know, in preparation for our podcast. This is one of them. This is called Creation and Blessing. It's a commentary on the book of Genesis. It's so valuable. If you had to get any one book on Genesis, this would most likely be the one. And I want to read a couple pages. Go ahead. Did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to point out, Bob, you know, this is one of those chapters that if I hadn't been coached by you in Bible reading, mm-hmm. this would have been one of those chapters.
Yeah, you put the fan on this, okay.
All right, so what are you reading me here?
I understand.
But becoming, over the last 2.5 years, you know, being coached by you is incredible, number one. But I was able to read this not as, okay, you're telling me about a bunch of, all right, this, okay, next chat, yeah, next. I read this, and I obviously still have questions.
Yeah, but you slowed down, and you thought, there's something, like your antenna was up.
Yeah,
You're like, there's something here.
Yeah, there's a couple of images that are used mm-hmm. in this chapter mm-hmm. that as I read it and read it again and read it again, I'm like, yeah. Huh. So I'm really glad that you brought in some
yeah. Plus I have to tell you, you're a great student, and you know, part of what we feel like with our podcast is if you could dedicate yourself to it. Mm-hmm. And even if you just got through Genesis, I don't know how many podcasts we've actually done, but we will have covered the book probably, I'm just guessing, in maybe 30 podcasts or so.
Right.
We've done these 50 chapters. But if you could just read on your own the material and then listen to the podcast, mm-hmm. you know, with your book, after 30 episodes, you would be a much better reader of the Bible. And if we achieve that with our listeners, what a joy.
Right.
What a joy. Boy, we're building a team that, you know, eventually could be really tough.
Well, and to use something right up your wheelhouse, swimming, you know, I can swim. Am I a swimmer?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, but if I was coached mm-hmm. as to the the intricacies of swimming, I would be a better swimmer.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's kind of, you know, why I feel very fortunate to not only be part of your congregation, but to be doing this podcast with you, is I think it makes us stronger swimmers. We can all swim. We can all read.
Oh, yeah.
But really, you know, swimming, that takes effort, and it takes
yeah, a lot
time.
Of practice. That's exactly right. So let's, I just want to read this. You can stop me. This is a couple pages worth of material.
Okay.
So our listeners are ready to just think through the book of Genesis with us, because we need this preparation before we read chapter 49. Even a casual reading of the book of Genesis reveals the prominence of the theme of blessing. The entire book turns on this motif and its antithetical motif, cursing. God's blessing gives the seed to the patriarchs and the land to the seed. The cursing alienates, subjugates, and disinherits. Later, prophets and historians expanded the motifs and applied them to future events. The word concerning the word blessing, a study of its uses in Genesis shows that the giving of a blessing bestowed prosperity with respect to fertility of land and fertility of life. The gift of divine blessing included the empowerment to achieve what was promised. God was therefore always the ultimate source of the blessing, even when it was communicated by an individual. The blessing in Genesis enriched that which was good. In Genesis 1 and 2, chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 3, for example, God blessed animal life, human life, the seventh day, all part of the creation that he had pronounced good. Everything in creation was good, but that which was blessed was enriched beyond its normal quality. God's blessing on the patriarchs granted unusual provision from above, so that the family could multiply and prosper phenomenally and enjoy a special status above the rest of the race. Since this blessing was from God, it came with the requirements of faith and obedience. Participation in the blessing of God was not for unbelievers who turned aside to evil. The antithetical idea of cursing is normally expressed with the verb, the Hebrew words pronounced arar, which means to impose a ban or a barrier, a paralysis on movement or other capabilities. Such power of cursing was not given to just anyone. It was given to authorities of society and state. Ultimately, the power to curse belonged to God, or an agency endowed by God with special power to invoke a curse. Anyone could imprecate, but imprecation was effectual only when it invoked a supernatural power. The curse in Genesis involved separation or alienation from the place of blessing, or even from those who were blessed. For example, Cain was cursed, and as a result had to flee from the fertile soil in the presence of the Lord. Occasionally, there were acts of judgment that did the work of the curse without actually pronouncing a curse. In such cases, there was no need for the warning that a curse brings, for the removal from the place of blessing was by swift intervention. And on occasion, there were circumstances and events, such as famine, death, and oppression, that indicated that a curse was present. A curse was occasioned by some evil act that destroyed life or disrupted God's established order or institutions. In Genesis, the curse is prominent in the first 11 chapters, for that part of the book traces the spread of sin once humans came to know good and evil. The emphasis on the curse is replaced in the patriarchal narratives by the prominence of the blessing, except for the warning of a curse for those who oppose God's program and God's people. Let's pause just for a second. I'll come back to it. But it is kind of an interesting observation that after Genesis 11, most of the cursing has been done, like, you know, in Genesis 3, the curse on the serpent, the curse on the land because of Adam and so on, and even things like that. But after chapter 11, see, Abraham starts in chapter 12. In this way, we may trace the message of the book through the motifs of God's blessing and cursing at the founding of the theocracy. When evil spoiled God's blessed creation and drew the divine curse, God set about to establish his program to restore blessing to the world through promises to his chosen seed. Promises that looked beyond the narratives of Genesis to the establishment of the promised theocracy. There's another side to this tension between blessing and cursing, a conflict that works on the human level and corresponds to the blessing and cursing. The motifs of good and evil characterize the human activities and circumstances in the struggle. That which is good is harmonious with the divine will. That which is evil conflicts with the divine will. Good describes obedient activities and pleasing circumstances meant to benefit and enhance life. Evil depicts sinful activities and unpleasant circumstances that interrupt and hinder life, causing pain and suffering. God blesses the good, but curses the evil. God's blessing, in turn, brings about good things, but his cursing ultimately destroys life. In the beginning of all, God's creation is called good. In fact, the creation of human life is very good. But in the garden, the humans were tempted with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and thinking that they would gain divine power over life to alter it for better or for worse, they fell into sin, succeeded only in bringing evil into the human experience. Here began the conflict between good and evil. And so in the very first setting, God instructed Cain to do good, for if he did not, sin would overwhelm him. With the experience of evil, however, early men and women were prone to disobey God and stray from his blessing. The motif of evil thus appears throughout the narratives of Genesis, reminding us of the sinful nature of the race and its unhappy circumstances. The basic use of this motif describes the evil acts of humans. Prior to the flood, the human nature became very evil, so that evil multiplied. The judgment of the flood was the only recourse for such wickedness. But even after the judgment, there was the recognition that the human heart is evil from childhood. During the early sojourn of Abraham, we encounter the spread of evil again in civilization, painfully reminding us of the need for God's blessing. But even in the chosen family, evil surfaced. In the activities of Joseph's brothers, the bright spot was Joseph's refusal to do that which was evil before the Lord. The words for evil also describe the painful deeds done to God's people. When Lot eventually took a stand for the Lord, the wicked sinners threatened to deal worse with him. Tensions of this sort were so common that treaties had to be made to keep people from doing harm to each other. But God ultimately protected his servant from evil. He did not allow Laban to say anything, good or evil, or do good or evil. Jacob was confident that God had not allowed Laban to harm him. So later, praise the angel who delivered him from evil. Evil also describes the treachery of Joseph's brothers as they sold him into slavery and blamed his disappearance on an evil beast. In the process of time, when Joseph tested his brothers, he accused them of repaying evil for good. Only at the end of the book do the brothers express how evil they had been when they appealed to Joseph for forgiveness. Evil actions bring evil results, and Genesis emphasizes this as well. The treachery of the brothers brought nothing but misery to Jacob, so that before Pharaoh he had to admit that his days had been few and evil. But even before this, the evil in the race had brought great judgment from God. First at the flood, then at the destruction of Sodom. But God had used such calamities to advance his cause of blessing. For example, in the days of Joseph, the bad cows signified the bad years of the famine, the occasion for the elevation of Joseph as the deliverer of his people. The text of Genesis also occasionally indicates the divine and human perception of evil. In addition to the passage that records how God saw that the race was evil, we read how the thing that Judah's sons did was evil in the sight of the Lord. And so swift judgment followed. And on the human side, we read how Esau's wives were evil to Isaac. In the final analysis, the human and the divine perception of evil come together in the wisdom of Joseph, who explained that his brothers did for him what his brothers did for him was intended for evil, but that evil was actually part of God's plan for good. Here we see how God's persistent plan to bless can actually triumph over evil and turn it back into good, as it had at the beginning of creation. Okay, did you have a question, Jamie? Or
well, what I was thinking, Bob, you know, before we took that little break is, you know, are we talking about evil being normal? How would you, you know, because as he's talked about evil and blessings in his description of Genesis, there are both, but since Genesis 3, is evil normal, or how would you describe
normal's evil? One word for it. You know, it's so hard sometimes to convey thoughts in theology, even when you're just talking, and as you try to do so, you know, over time you really gain an appreciation for the biblical authors because they're so balanced in that kind of thing. But normal is not the word I would use to describe it.
What would you say?
I would say evil permeates the creation now.
Since Genesis 3.
And God's blessing overcomes that and ultimately will completely overcome it when the great king comes back and
it's
puts
not,
down all evil.
It's not juxtaposed. It's not evil and good juxtaposed.
No, that's called dualism.
Right.
And no, the Bible's never dualistic. Satan's not anywhere near equal in power to God. He's compared to God. It's almost like a mathematical concept. No matter how big of a number you could name compared to an infinity, it might as well be zero.
Right.
100,
it's not enough.
100 is bigger than one, but compared to infinity, it's zero.
Right.
So the devil, compared to us, could almost appear godlike, but compared to God, he's zero. So, no, it's not dualistic. It's what I would call realistic. That curse is real.
Mm-hmm.
When God said, "Do not eat of that fruit or you will die," that was real, that warning. And we did. We became separate from God at that point. And so the rest of the story is him reaching back in to put the pieces back together. But not just, you know, our great friend Eddie Branscombe reminds me of this all the time. And it's not just that at the end of the story, at the end of the book of Revelation, where the pieces are put back together, they're put back together better than the whole thing is better off than it was at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just restored. It's like tried and true now. It was true, then it will be tried and true. Almost like a bone. I don't know if I could push this analogy too far, but yeah, I'm told medically that when you break a bone in your body and it heals, it's actually stronger than it was before. It's
mm-hmm.
that kind of concept.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. That makes total sense, Bob.
Evil's not normal. That's an okay word for it, but it permeates now.
Right. And I think that's something, you know, as not only the story goes on, but as we look at life, and again, back to the cosmic battle, it is there. It's not taking a day off. It's there all the time since Genesis 3.
That's right.
Am I on the right page?
It is, and one of the dangers in that is what we all go through, and you'll see it in many of the great biblical characters as well. You can see how they struggle with depression. Because they're looking at, they know God, And then they turn away from that, not turn away in apostasy, but their vision shifts and they turn away and look at the world. How could you not be depressed if mm-hmm. you've seen what real good is and now you're looking at real evil? That's hard. And you know, there's you have the story of Elijah, which we'll eventually get to, just laments his case. You know, I'm the only guy who believes you, Lord, out of, you know, God's right. going, no, you're not the only guy. But it's not a huge number. You know, when God says, no, you're not the only guy, I have 7,000 out of how many people on earth? You know,
at that point in time, yeah.
He's depressed. Jeremiah's very depressed, curses the day he was even born. So that's understandable, and yet there's this ultimate, but I know that's not forever. We do not mourn like those who have no hope. We know that what is going to happen in the future. We know Jesus has already come, and we know when he comes back, it's going to be unbelievable. You know, you're beyond your wildest dreams. And you really mean that, because our wildest dreams are tainted with evil. Jesus, it will be pure. That's the best word for it. Pure. You will be fully what you were created to be.
Well, and to take something that you've shared with us, Bob, at Bible studies, you know, one of the common characteristics of a Christian is suffering.
That's almost, there's really kind of two badges. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if you could, if we had to make it visual. If real Christians, you know, walked around on earth with two badges on their chest, one love and the other suffering, that's a real Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be intimately familiar with both of those things.
Right.
And that's the picture I get when I read the Word.
Sure. Absolutely.
Paul was very much like that. I mean, and many times your joy and love is just overflowing. And at the same time, you're in the midst of really difficult circumstances. How many times, you know, as you read through the New Testament, will Paul be in prison and he'll be praising God and speaking wonderful things?
How many times do we, in today's day and age, look at things and not correlate the suffering with where we're supposed to be? Does that make sense, that question?
Say it again.
How many times in our lives do we not look at the suffering as a blessing?
Well, we want to leave that out of the equation,
right.
Basically.
Right. We don't want the pain.
It's part of the equation. It's almost, you know, as we've been saying in church, it's almost one side of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the blessing coin has suffering on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one coin.
Right. Right.
So what I wanted to emphasize before we read some more, we're getting close to the end of this section, but listen to these words again. In the final analysis, the human and divine perception of evil come together in the wisdom of Joseph. He's just a gigantic character that I'm not sure we spend enough time studying, you know, to internalize exactly who Joseph was and the power of who he was. He's known for his wisdom, and you see that in his statecraft, you know, how he prepares Egypt and thus Israel and so on for the famine. But he could see, like we'll often use this term at Bible study, Joseph could see the world through God's eyes. And he will say at the end of Genesis to his brothers, you meant this for evil, but God meant this for good. He could see the whole picture. And we hold that out to ourselves and our listeners, that is, if we could impart even a step in that direction of that ultimate goal of our listeners being able to see the world through God's eyes, where you're seeing, both the evil and the good, and how that all works together in God's sovereign plan. I almost want to say you've conquered life at that point. You could soar.
Well, yeah, if you could see that.
You would fly like an eagle through life if you could see with that kind of perception. You could see good and evil the way God sees it and how it all works together. And, most of the time we're just children, Jamie, sitting in the lap of the Lord, drinking in his words and nodding our head, but really not having the, we're just enjoying the relationship,
right?
More than we are actually growing up. But growing up takes time. But Joseph's the example of that. The blessing and the curse, he could see how it worked together. And what a phenomenal character.
Well, and I think it's important, Bob, to bring up the realization of what Joseph went through. That it wasn't just a red carpet from the time he was born to the time that he died. It wasn't just a pearl-paved road for him. It was difficult.
Yeah, as you think through any life, typically we think of our defining moments. If I said, Jamie, tell me about your life in half an hour, you would pick your defining moments,
right.
Understandably so. What were Joseph's defining moments? Well, I had this dream, okay, that's one. Number two, my 11 brothers tried to kill me.
Because of it.
Yeah, because of it. And then number three, things started to look okay down in Egypt, but then I got thrown in prison because I resisted this guy's wife's advances. So, yeah, my defining moments, let's see, two of them really bad, one of them unfulfilled.
Right.
That would have been his life story.
Right.
For most of his life until God had him where he wanted him. Not that God necessarily needed to, I don't think God was, punishing him early on or building character. We tend to look at it that way in a false, pious kind of way. Oh, God was building. It looked like Joseph had great character from day one. I don't think God was building him that way so much. I mean, he might have been, but that's not the picture you get from the text. The
right.
picture you get from the text is it's a fallen world.
Sure.
And God's working that whole thing together for good, but that's necessarily going to involve you suffering.
Well, and that's a hard thing for, I would say, most people to really put their arms around is, as you brought up this past Sunday, Bob, if you ask most people, is the world good or is it bad?
Oh, human nature. It's almost, in our westernized view, we believe it's good. And I'm not saying we as Christians, but the prevailing view in the West. And that's 180 degrees wrong.
I agree.
You can't but help steer off the cliff if you're 180 degrees wrong on one of the most basic questions in life.
Right.
So just so our listeners know, if you're listening to this thinking that you are good in the very substance of your nature, you're not. God is going to redeem you if you put your faith and trust in him, and you will ultimately be completely delivered from that. Your deliverance has begun, but it'll be completed someday. But no, you weren't born good. No, you don't have a good nature. And that's all of us. And the key to getting out of that is recognizing it in the first place.
Can't ignore it.
So let's finish out this passage. And again, I'm reading from a book called Creation and Blessing by Alan Ross. And it's a commentary on the book of Genesis. Juxtaposed with the motif of evil throughout the book is the motif of good. From the beginning, tension between good and evil to the final triumph of good over evil and God's plan to restore the blessing. Beginning with the creation, we see that good describes God's blessed provision for the race. all creation was good in chapter 1, as was the food, chapter 2, verse 9, the gold in verse 12, the life itself, whether a newborn child or the long life of peace with God. The bounty of the earth was also good, as evidenced by the 7 good years that God would send to Egypt before the bad years. Interpretation that was good in the eyes of Pharaoh. At the heart of God's goodness to his people was the promise of the blessing. For when that promise was reiterated, good things were included. Accordingly, other rulers gave to God's people good land, good gifts, all because God's plan was intended for good. It will be clear in the exposition of Genesis that the motifs of blessing and cursing and good and evil appear repeatedly, tracing the theological message of the book. They vividly portray why and how God set about to establish his plan through the seed of Abraham. The conflict between good and evil rises up again and again in the narratives, sometimes with the motifs clearly expressed and sometimes implied. At each stage in the development of God's theocratic program, as evil threatened to jeopardize the blessing, the Lord either prevented it or overcame it. For those who persisted in opposing the Lord and his blessing, the swift judgment was guaranteed. But for those who, by faith, submitted to him and obeyed his word, then blessing was assured. So that's his summary of, in a big picture kind of way, the theology of the book of Genesis, and his use of blessing and curse and the near synonyms good and evil. We have described, we've put a title over all of that called The Cosmic Battle. Mm-hmm. And as you think of Genesis is just the doorway into the rest of the scriptures. I mean, everything that you see after Genesis through the book of Revelation was already inherent in the book of Genesis. It's the big package that everything's wrapped up in. Thus, we have our title for all of the Bible and all of our podcasts of fighting the cosmic battle.
Well, and I think if you look at, what the chapters and verses that we've gone through thus far, and tonight we're gonna finish out chapter 49. It's not immediate.
What's not immediate?
How do I put this in? How do I verbalize this, Bob? It's. Joseph wasn't just, poof, you're great. And he had a great wife.
No,
Abraham,
our lives
100
are...
years with no children and being told by God, you are going to be the father of nations. You see the stars, count the sand. It's not immediate. And I know for myself, that's something I struggle with, and that's why I bring it up for our listeners, is it's not Christian magic.
Deliverance can often be immediate, but the blessing is often, has to fight its way through the fallen world.
Mm-hmm. It has to, I don't want to say be nurtured, but it has to...
It has to overcome. It has to overcome in such a way that... there's preservation of the seeds of good. I'm sort of fishing around for the way to say it. What I mean is this. God has the power to instantly change it right now.
Right.
Any act he wants to do, he's omnipotent. So could Jesus return in the next 5 seconds and establish God's ultimate enduring heavenly kingdom forever on earth? Yeah, he could. Well, then what... Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a reason for the delay. And, we talk about this at church all the time. The wheat and the tares are growing together. Mm-hmm. And he has a purpose for that. And ultimately, his wisdom will be borne out when we look back. Just like Joseph doesn't pronounce his wisdom, of being able to see how good and evil work together until chapter 50. In chapter 38, he's not saying that.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
He's looking around at 39, actually,
right,
and forward. He's looking around, you know, trying to make sense of what goes going on.
Mm-hmm.
But in chapter 50, he can finally see. So
he doesn't reveal himself to his brothers immediately.
No, that's right. Everything, you know, unfolds over time. And so we will one day be able to look back and understand what was going on in our lives. But in the meantime, what has to guide us is our faith. And that's what we're going to see in chapter 49 is Jacob pronouncing blessing on his 12 boys, his 12 children. He had women. He had Dinah, was a girl, and others, I'm sure, that aren't mentioned in the text. But he is going to pronounce a blessing on the future of the nation Israel by faith. Not by wisdom. By faith. Wisdom, you know, is looking back on things and understanding, you know, what's going on. And that may well, hindsight, that may well provide you with wisdom for the future, you know, how to guide your steps and so on. But faith is different than wisdom. There's overlap in the two terms, but Jacob's going to do this by faith.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to look down the corridors of time through God's eyes, and there's a sense in which it's going to be vague. I want to say, I don't know if that's exactly the right term, but as we see it, as we begin to read the words of Genesis 49, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's like, what are you saying? And there's a number of passages like that in the Old Testament that I'll bring up when we actually get to this, why that's the case. But he's going to be looking by faith down the corridors of time and pronouncing these blessings over the nation of Israel. We'll look at why he's doing that and what's going on. That'll be chapter 49. But I just didn't feel comfortable jumping into that chapter until we reviewed the big story. What's going on? You know, often
right,
we do pretty good with the small, you know, this verse means this
mm-hmm.
verse means that.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't put it together. We're not looking at the big picture. And both of those things are so important, the big picture and the small picture as well. So.
Well, and chapter 49 is important, you know, from my understanding, as far as understanding the author and understanding the audience. Author Moses, right?
That's right.
Audience, Israelites.
That's right.
Date,
1450 B.C.
Right.
Coming out of Egypt, bunch of slaves, wondering who Moses is, who this God is, who apparently has delivered them. But, man, they're not eating as good as they used to eat. And
well, in chapter 49, as we get into it, it's really going to set the stage for what is coming. I mean, we've had several. I mean, Noah, Abraham's faith, the fall, Adam and Eve, creation. I mean, the stage is really getting set. But from what I read, Bob, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's really setting up for the Israelites, who are his chosen people. It's like, all right, here's where you started. Here's the beginning. Am I missing?
No, you're right. And you really spark a number of comments on my part. I just say, you know, as I hear you recount some of these things, I get, you know, this mixed feeling. One is joy that you're doing that, and one is frustration that if we went into the pews in America and said, hey, tell me what's going on in Genesis. Give me some main characters. You're going to get some blank stares. And that just frustrates me to no end.
Mm-hmm.
That Christians don't know the story. Because
right,
it all unfolds from these foundational chapters. If you don't have the beginning down,
yeah,
who could understand any book? I mean, take, you know, your greatest
mm-hmm.
book that you've ever read, and I've got so many. You've been over at my house. I mean, I want people to know this that are listening. I don't just read the Bible, though maybe maybe I should. I don't say that with pride, but I love stories. You know, I grew up as a boy. My mom couldn't control me. I was her most difficult kid, but she gave me books to read. And I think mostly looking back on it to keep me out of trouble. But I began to learn, you know, very young how wonderful stories were. But all that to say, any of my favorite stories would be nothing if I didn't read the first 50 pages of them. I wouldn't know what was going on.
Well, think about a Hardy Boys mystery. How are you going to know what the ending is?
If you didn't know the crime, it would be so frustrating to read the book that way. In fact, what would happen? And by the way, we're being generous, saying, maybe it's just the first 50 pages in. They don't know the first 1,500 pages of a 2,000-page book. Well, and if you don't know that, hold on just for a sec, sorry to interrupt you. If you don't know that, and every Sunday you go and listen to bits and pieces of the story, you have no idea what's going on. No idea. And so you're ineffectual. And you could be a major player in this battle, but you're on the sidelines because you don't know any... Here I am slipping into... You know, it's like sports and Super Bowl's coming up next week, right?
Right.
Or this Sunday, right?
Right.
The Super Bowl. Okay, can you imagine either Aaron Rodgers or Ben Roethlisberger, you know, in the huddle saying, okay, here's the play, and it's some code, you know, dog slant on three, whatever, you know, A gap. And can you imagine him saying that and... Most of those guys in that huddle had no idea what he just said. Can you imagine how bad they would get crushed if they did not know the playbook?
Well,
even football, a completely physical game, a ton of what those guys are doing during the week is in the classroom.
Sure.
They're learning the playbook, what they got to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And as Christians, we're basically just saying, you know, be a better person. And it's like, you have no idea of the playbook.
Well, and we you know, and I will lump myself into there. We spend a lot of time on the New Testament and not remembering what happened, you know, and Jesus doesn't forget the Old Testament.
No.
And
I forget the percentage, Jamie, but it's something like, I don't want to be too far wrong on this, but it's something like 20% of the New Testament is just quotes from the Old.
Sure. Sure,
so,
that may, yeah.
My friends at school, I've said this on occasion, and I confess I was a New Testament major when I was in my studies the second time. But my Old Testament friends would just say, why are you just studying the appendix? Why don't you?
Is that what they called it, the appendix?
Yeah, that the New Testament is just the appendix to the Old. You know, why don't you study the meat of it? And it's, you know, tongue-in-cheek, but there's a lot of truth in what they were saying.
Well, and as we get into the chapter, Bob, you know, it really is, and I can put myself in that category. You know, I was raised Catholic, and you know, we didn't really get the full story. You know, we got bits and pieces, but until I took it upon myself to start learning the story, It wasn't happening, and I know for myself, and I can only share this with our listeners, that it's very important to understand the Old Testament. It's very important to understand where you came from, and what you know what you got to understand the whole story.
Absolutely.
You know, and yeah, you shared that with me, Bob. I remember the first question you asked me when we sat down 2.5 years ago was, have you read the Bible? And I can remember it vividly in my mind. I said, yeah, Bob, I was raised Catholic. I know the Bible. He said, well, Jamie, I appreciate that, but have you read the Bible? And my answer, my honest answer, had to be no, because I hadn't. And so you challenged me to read the Bible. And I started at page 1, and I started reading this.
There you go.
And
now you're light years ahead in just 2.5 years of most Christians in Western Christianity.
Well, and
because you read the story.
Well, and you would get the questions from me. You got the calls from me. Hey, Bob, I don't get this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand it. You know, and which I think led to our podcast, you know, so that we could, you know,
yeah,
ask the questions, answer them. I don't want to say answer them like we're answering for God, but
yeah, just provide guidance. I'm well aware when we quote answer questions, we're giving it our this is our ballpark, you know. Mm-hmm. But provide guidance is how I would.
Yeah, and it's very important that we get that. I've learned, and I share this with my family. I share this, Bob, and you know this about me. I share this with everybody I know. Yeah. Know the story.
Yeah. You know what? Another thing, we'll get into chapter 49, you know, soon. But another thing that you're a great example of is through you and your wife, you know, at the same time, but you're the head of the family. Your whole family has come to faith in a powerful way. Your children are very strong evangelists in their own right.
And I've got to point out, Bob, it's not me saying to them, you will,
.. It's organic.
Right.
It happens naturally.
Yes, it was very natural.
When the heads of the family, you know, really get this, it happens naturally in their family.
Well, and as we were talking earlier, you know, part of our calling is to evangelize, you know, all of us. And, you know, my sons are very strong with their friends. And
yep.
Which, you know, for our listeners, I would like to share with them that's where we want our children to be.
Yep.
We want them to be strong in the faith. We want them to stand strong in their belief. We want them to stand strong in the presence of God with His Word. And, you know, it wasn't through Bible studies or anything like that, Bob. It was them really internalizing these words.
Yeah, they heard the words. And when I say heard, I mean in the biblical sense of heard. They heard and understood.
Mm-hmm. And put it into action.
Yeah, and they're not done, of course, but what they have heard, they've understood. And so they're very good about talking to their peers and friends.
So, Bob, you know, I really like the direction you took, you know, today as we're wrapping up, or tonight as we're wrapping up Genesis. I really appreciated the blessing and the curse.
Yeah, now when we read this, we'll have a much better, we'll absorb it better.
So, should we bring this particular podcast to a close?
Let's pray now and then admonish our listeners that plug into the next one.
That's right.
This was warm-up for the text.
All righty, my friend.
Lord, may we attain to the wisdom of Joseph. In Jesus' name.